Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the second of our Hobbit spoiler special podcasts. The last one, if you haven't heard it, features Hobbit co-writer Philippa Boyens waxy and lyrical on the scriptwriting process, and is well worth a listen. This one, on the other hand, is simply an in-depth discussion of the film in wonderfully spoilery detail. And help me out, on this perilous quest are three noble warriors who may be small in stature, but they're big in hobbity nuggets. It's Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Dan Jolin.
Well met, my friend.
And Nick Desemlian.
Hello.
Hello, indeed. Let's get cracking. I'm going to be organised and try and break this into sections and questions that you guys have been sending us via Twitter, Facebook, and our podcast at empireonline.com account. So this one is on Twitter. It's from @H2DB. When Gandalf sees Bilbo put the ring in his pocket, is this implying he always knew he had the ring?
It's kind of implied in The Lord of the Rings, if I remember, when Gandalf talks about Bilbo having the ring. Obviously, by that stage, he knows what it is. He figures out what it is exactly at the beginning of The Lord of the Rings. Mm. He knows there's something going on. He knows there's something there. He knows Bilbo has something. He doesn't know exactly what that is at this point in The Hobbit.
I can't remember.
He has to go to the library.
Yeah, he goes to Gondor.
Oh, so he finds out what it is. So at this point in The Hobbit, he just knows that Bilbo is hiding something, but he doesn't know exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And so, it's been a while since I read The Hobbit, so refresh my memory. Does the ring play a major part going forth?
In The Hobbit?
Invisibility does play a part in Mirkwood against the dangers there, and also when they get to the Lonely Mountain.
And the Elf King's Hall.
Which is in Mirkwood.
Okay.
And then later at the Lonely Mountain, it's what enables him to get in there and first sort of encounter Smaug. Smaug can't see him, but becomes aware that there's something there over time.
Okay.
I went back and looked at the book again this morning and looked up, and there is a moment in the book in The Hobbit where Gandalf looks suspicious, even though when Tolkien wrote that, he didn't know that Lord of the Rings was coming.
He actually went back and rewrote sections of The Hobbit to tie in more closely with the Lord of the Rings. So that was probably from the more recent edition. I don't think there's many copies of the original edition, because originally it was just a magic ring that made him invisible. And then he later on had this whole idea.
Yeah, I think it was still in the first draft, actually.
Was it? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Is there a sense in The Hobbit, again, refresh my memory, that the ring is corrupting Bilbo at some point, doing what it does to Frodo?
No, it's a slower process than that. I mean, again, as Dan said, basically the 1950, I think it was, rewrite of The Hobbit is what introduced what the now familiar elements. The riddle scene was completely different in the original book. Actually, Gollum was a better guy. Bilbo picks up the ring, hides it in his pocket, and they are riddling for the ring. Gollum says promises he'll give Bilbo the ring if he wins the riddle contest. And then Gollum is mortified that he doesn't have the ring to give him and feels like he's, you know, let Bilbo die. And Bilbo doesn't bother to enlighten him and gets him to show him the way out as well. So actually Bilbo's very sneaky in the very original draft of The Hobbit, and Gollum's actually an okay guy-ish.
What a dick.
I know, right? So that's why he changed it.
Unbelievable. Okay, so that's that one sorted out. This one's from at Timon Singh on Twitter. Did Richard Armitage, a.k.a. Thorin Oakenshield, have enough slow-mo hero action shots or not enough? Where do we stand on the ratio?
Well, that's a loaded question, isn't it?
I will say that I think that the shot of him, which I think is in the trailer as well, so people have seen, of him walking away from the burning tree, very, very closely for me echoed the scene at the end of Fellowship of the Ring, where Aragorn's walking towards the orcs as they come up. As they come up the hill, just taking his sword out. I think it's a very deliberate echo, but it very much matches that shot.
He doesn't have quite as good a door opening moment as Aragorn in The Two Towers. It's probably the most dramatic opening of the door in cinema. Thorin just goes, there's a very good knock.
Yeah.
The actual door opening.
Yeah. He is the one who knocks.
Yeah.
We can hope that he ends up with as good a one in the second film.
There are more doors to come.
Breaking Radagast. The treatment of the dwarves in The Hobbit is very, very interesting, because previously in the three movies, and I know Nick and Dan are huge fans of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, I am less so, so it'd be interesting to see what you guys think about this. Gimli now is seen largely, I think, as comic relief, and so it's interesting to me to see dwarves that were meant to take seriously and meant to almost treat them as heroes.
That's disgusting. That attitude is terrible.
It's not. I'm not being dwarfist.
Oh, dwarves
not,
to be taken seriously.
Oh, God.
How
I've turned,
can we do
I've
that?
Turned into Carl Pilkington, but... You know, it's an interesting shift in tone.
Obviously, it's a different thing, isn't it? Because Gimli is the only dwarf, you know, and he has that role in The Fellowship, which falls into mostly a comic relief one, although not quite as bad as Merry and Pippin. But here, the whole group are dwarves, so obviously you're going to have different flavours of dwarf. Mm. 50 Shades of Dwarf.
Oh, please, no.
Oh, God.
The spin-off's happening. You know what's happening. And what about the, for example, some people have written in about this as well, the fact that, for example, Killy, the Aidan Turner character, has virtually no prosthetics whatsoever. Richard Armitage has very few prosthetics, and there's a couple of dwarfs that are almost hunky in a weird way.
Maybe he is seen as a freakishly ugly dwarf. Because he looks so human-like. He's shunned.
There's an age range. There is that. There's a great age range. Filly and Killy are actually very, very young dwarves.
Yeah.
Whereas you get up to Balin, and he's clearly a very advanced years. So, you know, I think they say that your nose and your chin never stop growing, do they?
They never stop growing.
So you can imagine how with dwarves who live over hundreds of years, there would be a greater change in their physical appearance over that time.
It's effective as well in just helping us keep track of these 14 different or 13 different dwarves, which I think could otherwise be a difficult thing. You know, ultimately, having at least one guy without a beard does really help things. Also, you know, Aidan Turner is very pretty, so
he is. He's not bad.
Okay, and what about the structural comparisons to Lord of the Rings?
Well, I mean, people have remarked extensively on the structural similarities of this story and Fellowship of the Ring. I mean, they get to the other side of the Misty Mountains, so it's roughly the same kind of journey starting off in Hobbiton. You know, you've got a big action scene under the mountains. You've got a stop off in Rivendell just before that. You've got a couple of, you know, near run-ins just prior to getting to Rivendell. So, you know, a lot of the beats are the same, but then if you're turning that book into three films, that's kind of inevitable, you know, just because of the starting point.
In its favour, there is only one elf stop, whereas in Fellowship there were two. And I always thought if they were, you know, I always felt, even though I do love Fellowship of the Ring, I felt they could have maybe melded the two elf stops in some way.
Meld Rivendell and Lorien? Have you no idea of the cultural significance of both?
In this one, Galadriel, you know, she astrally projects herself into Rivendell, doesn't she? So she can be there. You still have a Galadriel, but it's in Rivendell. They could have done that, couldn't they? A Fellowship, rather than all that other, you know, singing elves thing.
You're saying Galadriel was too lazy to come down to Rivendell?
Yeah.
Save some time.
Yeah, she should shake her leg.
I like the Lothlórien sequence. I think it's cool.
I do too.
It's a different side of the elves. It's important.
All right. Okay. There is that. It's important to the story, but I'm just saying. You know, there could have been a case for adapting the two into one. I don't know.
I don't agree.
Fair enough.
Duel.
Fight him. I guess it raises a larger point as well. A lot of people have raised this in the past. Does this need to be three films? We talked about this when the announcement was first made. We were wondering at the time, and now we know where this movie ends off and what roughly movies two and three are going to tackle. Hmm. But do we still think that it needs to be three films?
I have some thoughts on what could potentially have been cut, in my opinion. I think the Frodo stuff, as much as I like Frodo, I think that there's 10 minutes there which could have easily gone. It doesn't really add much. You find out the backstory of the party invite, but other than that. And I also thought the first warg attack, I didn't think you needed to have two action sequences with wargs. I thought that sequence was quite geographically confused as well. So to me, it looked like they were in Rohan.
Mm. I agree, actually. I think the one thing I would immediately change if I were given this film and some scissors is Azog. I feel like you have, you know, it's kind of in the book to whatever extent you have. Obviously, Thorin has issues with Smaug, the dragon. He has issues with the elves, and that again is hinted at, maybe not fully developed in the book, but it's very much there. So I was okay with the sort of the setup of a grudge against Thranduil. I was okay with the setup of a grudge against the dragon. But introducing this random orc who's got a personal issue with Thorin, you begin to wonder if it's Thorin himself. Is he the guy?
To an extent, I get that, but they're not going to change the book enough so that obviously Thorin kills Smaug, and
sure,
he's not going to bump off any elves. So I can see why they gave him a nemesis, because he's going to have a moment of triumph over Azog at some point in the second or third of the movie, surely.
They're actually going to introduce another orc called Bolg, B-O-L-G, who is the son of Azog. And when I interviewed Richard Taylor, he mentioned that he's got a pretty extreme look. He's got a Mordor sort of surgery happening with bits of his face bolted together and stuff. So there's going to be a father and son team coming up against
them. I felt like that was just a grudge too far. It's like there are orcs, okay? They're bad guys. They're all bad guys. They're by nature, they're twisted and evil. They have been twisted. And therefore, they're going to chase you anyway. You don't need a personal grudge. And that was one of my major issues. I thought that could have been cut. I do feel like I have some sympathy with the idea of making The Hobbit as two movies, I have to say. I think given that it is a linear story, given that so many people love so many different elements of it, it would be a very, very difficult thing to do in one movie and keep what people love about the book. Whether it needs to be three movies, I think is slightly another issue. And also whether they need to be, if they're all this length, I think it might feel a little bit slow.
I've got to say, I'm getting quite exasperated by people who are going, oh, look, it's only that big, the book. How can they make three films out of that? It's a smaller book than Lord of the Rings because mm-hmm. of the way it's written. In terms of incident, happens, it's not that much a smaller story, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I have a lot of sympathy with that argument. Yeah. And I also think a lot of what they've done to kind of make the story longer and give it the kind of depth and the tone that Lord of the Rings had, I think a lot of that is really, really successful. Yeah. I'm really excited to see them going up against the necromancer on screen. I'm really excited to see that whole side of things kind of tackled on screen, because I think it's one of the great, intriguing, off-page incident in literature, never mind just in Tolkien's work. And therefore, I think it's, you know, that kind of stuff is really exciting to me. I like that they've developed the role of the elves. I like that that's all happening. I just felt that some issues, and particularly Azog, I felt was introduced for purely cinematic structuring issues and not because, you know, narratively he needed to be there. And that was my issue.
Yeah, I wouldn't have had such a bigger problem with that character if he'd been a bit more interestingly written. There is a scene where he dispenses one of his minions that you've seen 100 times before in films, and they didn't really do anything interesting or special with it. I just thought that was a pointless scene, generic.
I did think they found a nice structure for the film in terms and character terms for Bilbo, sort of pointing out this idea, which actually I never really got from the book. It was never really sold in the book by Tolkien, but I love this idea that the dwarves are a people who have lost their home. They're all refugees. And this is what the quest for Erebor is about, ultimately, about finding their home, about regaining their home. I mean, we get a bit of that with the idea of Moria and the significance of Moria to the dwarves in The Lord of the Rings. But and this idea that Bilbo has, you know, his Tookish side has got the better of him, and he's off on this adventure, and he keeps questioning, why the hell am I here?
Yeah.
What am I doing? And this does happen in the book. He keeps, you know, dreaming of being back in his armchair, and I was just saying to himself, what am I doing? And Martin Freeman and the script sold that really well in this film. And I love the fact that the film's structure was around him realizing what it was at the heart of his motives for joining them. And he realizes, and, you know, there is that moment where he almost says, you know what, sod this, I'm going home, which doesn't happen in the book either. And then he realizes, hang on a minute, I want to go home because I love my home. These guys have got no home to go to. And then it becomes all about his love for his home, weirdly becomes his motivation for helping them. I thought that was beautiful storytelling, beautiful adaptation. So that gave them a free pass, and I'll let them off the Azog business.
I'm not sure about a free pass, but I did like that as well. I thought Martin Freeman just generally was absolutely terrific as Bilbo. I can't imagine anyone else doing nearly as good a job.
Yeah.
Although Thorin does have a bit of a psych-out moment where he's like, you guy. Give him a big hug. I love ya.
Interesting, Tom, about Azog. A couple of people tweeted in, which confused me a little bit. They were asking about the CGI effects in The Hobbit, Jackson's decision to go largely CGI with this, as opposed to practical effects in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And Nick, you can probably correct me in this one. I thought Azog was played by a guy in prosthetics. He's not. Is he CG? I'm confused.
No, he's not prosthetics. It's mocap.
It's mocap.
Same as, performance capture, yeah. Same as Gollum. But to me, that character looked blatantly CG in a way that Gollum didn't. I don't know. Why exactly?
It didn't work for me. I thought it was a guy wearing a suit. So
it looked to me like the engineer in Prometheus.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's exactly what I was about to say. That's exactly the comparison I was going to make.
Which I think was the same thing. There was a British, young British drama student who played the engineer. But again, it had a weird sort of CG sheen to the character.
There was just that little bit of shininess, that little bit of, I don't know, something.
Yeah, a bit waxy.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it was obviously, I thought it was obvious, you know, it was mocapped, but I didn't have a problem with it, you know, certainly no more than I did with Gollum in the first Lord of the Rings trilogy. In other words, not at all.
I really did.
Even though I could see it.
And with the goblins generally, I thought that I loved those glimpses in Fellowship when they're surrounded by all the goblins, and Jackson does all these close shots of these hideous, you know, they're clearly real practical things, but they look like bug-like and hideous and nightmarish. And in this, I thought the goblins looked sort of a bit kind of lumpy and samey and fake.
Okay.
To me, that was a sort of peeve that I had.
I clearly need to go down to my nearest Specsavers, because not only did I think 48 frames per second was fine, I thought that Azog was a guy in a suit. So I'm worried. Are you actually here? Can I actually see you? Oh my god! I've got problems.
No, we're all played by Andy Serkis.
Andy Serkis is playing us all right now. Yeah.
He's always playing us. Johan Carlson on Twitter at Rukula asks. Related question, I guess. What do you think of the design choices of effects, the trolls, the Goblin King, etc.? We've kind of answered that one, haven't we?
The trolls look great. I like the one with the roomy eye.
Hmm. Yeah, they look good, and the Goblin King looked great as well. It's like properly repulsive.
The Goblin King looked CG to me. I mean, someone said to me before going in, he's a bit like Boss Nass, and he's not. And he's got these massive testicles hanging down from his chin, which was weird and kind of off-putting, but. You know, when he's played by Barry Humphries, I was expecting a sort of Les Patterson kind of character, but he's not that.
He's fine
as a character, but I don't think the effect works entirely yet. Dame Edna would have been really fun. Someone else has written in. Hang on 2 seconds. David Heslop, talking about the 48 frames per second, the HFR controversy. I don't know if it is a controversy, whether people are just getting their knickers in a twist for nothing. He says he thought that the HFR made transition between CG and live action seamless, and the Goblin Town was the greatest CG location I've ever seen. Agree? Disagree?
Well, it's good to actually have a positive question as opposed to trying to lead us into making criticisms. I wasn't sold on HFR, 48 FPS, myself. I think that 24 frames per second, I think, has become a very important part of the suspension of disbelief process of watching a film. Kind of like, you know, the distance between where you're sitting in a theatre and the stage. That's kind of my wonky analogy is, would a play be as good if you were sat on the stage with the actors? No, you'd be sitting right next to them. You'd be going, look at that makeup. That's ridiculous. All that eyeshadow. Eyeliner.
Okay.
All that eyeliner. Makeup confusion. So I kind of felt that the loss of the blurring in a way, sharpened it up just that much too much for a fantasy visual effects spectacular. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see more nature documentaries, big screen nature documentaries done in 48 frames per second. That would be amazing. I didn't enjoy it for this kind of film. I thought it would have benefited from the graininess and the motion blur.
I mentioned it to David Attenborough last week when we interviewed him.
Oh yeah.
And said you should do some IMAX things. He didn't seem to know too much about it, but hopefully he'll get onto it now.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you pointed it out to him.
Okay.
Because this is a spoiler podcast, let's talk about some of the second and third act developments.
Sure.
And maybe some of the characters in greater detail. Let's start with Radagast.
Mm.
Radagast the Brown, played by Sylvester McCoy. An interesting character, a lighter character in the context of the film. What did we think of him?
I like him. I didn't necessarily like all the business around him. That's my kind of overall impression. You know, I mean, Radagast is like a paragraph in Fellowship of the Ring. You know, he's mentioned as the other wizard, and we barely get to any detail on him. But he's always been, again, one of these great sort of off-page intriguing figures in Middle Earth. And it was really exciting to see that he was going to be in this and that he was going to play a part. And I think that Sylvester McCoy does a really fantastic job. You've got to have him enough of a wizard to kind of stand next to Gandalf and not look silly, but at the same time he's got to be different enough to really stand apart, and I think he absolutely did that. What I didn't love was all, you know, the business with hedgehogs and bunny sleighs and
are you
stuff.
A Sebastian the Hedgehog hater? Is that what you are?
Well, I couldn't hate a hedgehog like that. It's a very cute hedgehog, but it I don't know, it just it verged on too cute. I think the things together, you know, it kind of built up and felt a bit too cute overall. I think, you know, the idea of him being very close to nature kind of worked. I think the idea of, you know, the literal bird's nest in his hair, I thought was clever and funny. I mean, he's literally got, you know, bird shit in his hair. It's kind of fun. Not in real life, just on screen. But, you know, if you add in together cute hedgehogs and cute bunnies and the slaying and his own sense of quirk, it begins to be a bit sort of adorkable and a little bit too Zooey Deschanel.
I liked it. He's quite a Tom Bombadil-y character in a way. It's interesting that Jackson cut Tom Bombadil out of The Lord of the Rings, but has actually inserted a character who is kind of on the same wavelength. And I actually really like the character. I'm really looking forward. I'm guessing that in the second and third films, he's really going to come into play.
I think so too. And I think it's, if we're being spoilerific, let's be honest, it's probably not going to end well for him.
I suspect he's going to die.
I think he's going to die.
Do you think he'll go boss-eyed before the final moment?
Oh, hopefully the rabbits live. I'm worried about them. There's a really nice touch with the rabbits when he's at Dol Guldur and the vampire bats come and start attacking and one of the rabbits is just thumping its leg up and down.
Yes.
While it's waiting for him to run back. I really like that. That was a really nice touch. I mean, the animals did look a bit too CG. You know, it's like with the gopher and Crystal Skull. Couldn't they find a real hedgehog?
Not one that can act with the...
It wasn't doing that much acting.
Hedgehog should have had the voice of Ray Winstone.
That would have been amazing.
He played a beaver last time.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I think
in terms of nice touches, I really like that little bit of dialogue when Bilbo was asking Gandalf about who all the wizards were. Who are the wizards? And I love the fact that there's two wizards that you just can't remember what their names are.
Yeah. Do they come into play in it?
No, I don't think they will.
Okay.
No. They've basically never come into play in anything. Mm. We know that they exist, but they've never been relevant to anything, and therefore they just don't get mentioned. Mm.
Why doesn't Gandalf do magic more often?
Because shut up.
Because it's he has to harness power in order to do it.
He has to plug his staff into the mains to recharge it.
Yeah, it's you know, he has to call upon his mana, you see. And his mana reserves are not limitless, Chris.
All right, sorry.
I'm becoming frightened of Dan.
Sorry. I didn't mind Radagast, interestingly enough. He's fine.
I liked him.
It's slightly annoying, but I love Sebastian.
I liked him as a character. The sled chase was slightly...
The rabbit sled is the must-have toy of... I don't care if they haven't made it, I want one. And if I have to attach real rabbits to a sled in order to get it, I will do so.
They enjoy it.
But
like huskies.
Yeah.
I love it.
I love the energy of McCoy's, that first moment where his eyes are kind of, you know, he's doing that kind of weird monologue and the spiders are creeping up on the hut. That was one of my favourite sequences in the film. Mm. I really loved it. It had that kind of twitchy energy of
old school Jackson.
Yeah, it did. Very much so. Absolutely.
All right, so Radagast. Someone had a question, actually. Why is Radagast in this film when he's only mentioned in the book? We kind of covered that one, but he never meets up with the dwarves and he kind of does in this one. He's leading them away, leading the war.
It's a clever thing. It's called an adaptation. It's quite cunning. Where you
take
elements of a story from a source material.
You don't have to be so glib.
And then you just kind of, you know, play around with them to make them more cinematic, God forbid, and drive the plot along, God forbid. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes things change.
It's a similar thing to the Eagles, where you wonder why he couldn't give them a lift in his sled.
Because they wouldn't be big enough. Yeah. They're rabbits, for crying out loud. They're rabbits.
Yeah, but think about it. The
13
rabbit,
dwarves.
Just think about it for a second.
Okay,
the rabbit sled gets from Mirkwood, Dol Guldur, a bloody long way. Then it turns around and it goes back and meets them at... On the other side
of the Misty Mountains as well. It crosses the mountains.
I presumed, and I may be wrong here, but he can... apparate.
Thanks, Harry Potter. I just want to blend the two franchises together.
He and the rabbits might have used the goblin zip line that got a goblin from the Misty Mountains all the way to where the orcs were and back.
Right.
In about 5 minutes of screen time.
Okay.
There are a few sort of chronological issues if you break it apart. But
then there are Empire Strikes Back, and we love that.
And we love that.
We do that.
We don't care about that. But speaking of sort of Deus Ex Machinas and things appearing out of nowhere, a lot of people have obviously alighted on the giant eagles.
Oh, the eagles!
But let me finish.
Well, Hotel California is a hell of a song.
Because it's interesting to me that it happens again, for one, but B...
It's in the book.
Yes, but B, at one point in the movie, Galadriel goes to Gandalf and says, basically, if you get in trouble and you need my assistance, then just call me and I'll come. And so when I watched the film for the first time, I presumed that that's what Gandalf had done, that little moth thing, that little butterfly thing was an emissary of Galadriel, and he had sent it off to ask Galadriel for help. Now, I'm told by Nick and Dan, who are Tolkien experts, and Helen as well, who's just looking affronted. Helen's also a Tolkien expert. What the hell am I doing here? I'm frightened. I don't know.
Go and get out.
Yeah,
we'll talk amongst ourselves.
Who's going to read this on my iPad then? that is not the case, that they didn't ask Galadriel for help, which makes me wonder exactly how bad did things have to get for Gandalf in order to ask Twilight's prize.
Typical man.
She was speaking in the context of this necromancer dude in Dol Guldur. She doesn't care about Smaug and the Horde of Erebor.
But they were on a tree about to fall off a big drop, and the tree was on fire, for God's sake.
He didn't need to help get Galadriel's help because he knew he was getting Eagle's help.
Yeah, he had a moth in his pocket, so... why would you want to talk to an elf queen? Everyone knows if you're in that situation, you take the moth out of your pocket and send them to the
giant eagles. Come. Yeah. Sorry.
I hope there's a deleted scene where the moth goes and has a chat with the eagles. And like, what's happening when the moth flies off?
Please don't eat me. Please don't eat me. I have a message from Gandalf.
Do eagles eat moths?
Chris, that was a reference back to the Fellowship of the Ring. Do you remember when Gandalf is imprisoned by Saruman at the
Saruman
Orthanc? He releases the moth and the eagle comes and saves him. That's the relevance of the moth.
Yeah, no, I get the relevance of the moth. I just don't know when he's going to call Galadriel.
He's going to call Galadriel probably in the next film when they go to Dol Guldur to confront the necromancer.
I'm just worried about her. I think she might get lonely.
Curiously enough, I was Googling.
She's got a husband.
I was bored the other night, very bored. So I was Googling the moths and the eagles and reading, going back to, because people have some pretty insane theories about the moth.
Really?
Yeah. And apparently, if you freeze frame a shot in Fellowship of the Ring, you can see the moth flying around in the Mines of Moria, which I don't believe for a second, but there's a whole school of thought convinced that that's true.
This is Room 237 style.
Yeah, this is moth 237.
I mean, there is a god in the Middle-earth universe. Basically, the god basically sent the wizards, who are essentially angels from the West, to sort things out in Middle-earth for him. And bestowed all the stuff on the elves early on, and they were kind of pre-Lapsarian society. So, maybe the moth is God, if we're going to get into
I always like the fact that the Lord of the Rings had no pantheon, do you know what I mean? Mm. I like the fact that there wasn't any divine intervention.
But then if you read the Silmarillion,
that's talking too far.
We've lost Chris. I think we may need to dial it back a little bit.
He thinks we're talking about Marillion now.
Yeah, sorry.
The Eagles, Marillion, what?
Yeah, I'm sending a moth to book me a taxi. all right, interesting stuff. I like the dwarves. Let's talk about the dwarves.
Please talk about the dwarves.
Let's talk about the dwarves, because there's no moths involved with the dwarves. We've kind of talked a little bit about how they're all different from one another, but do we have a favourite? How do we think they worked as a collective?
I thought they got the balance about right, because I think when you've got 13 dwarves, it can get a bit overwhelming, and they wisely didn't try to give everybody a big character moment this time around. They're all kind of there, they all kind of get something to do, but it's not like everyone gets the spotlight on him for 2 or 3 minutes at a time. There's just, there's a sense that these guys are, characters, are people. So I thought that was about right. I'm guessing that given that they have got 3 films, I think we're going to see more of them, especially I think in Mirkwood, the early stages of the journey through Mirkwood, that's where I think you've got a bit of time to kind of focus on the dwarves themselves without any other business going on
There'll be more Bomber then, won't they? Because Bomber didn't really have any moments.
He's one of the bigger roles. He broke a table.
But in the book, he's forever complaining about everything, basically. He's forever falling behind. He's forever, they're forever having to wait for him to catch up, etc. And I think, that's probably going to become more of an issue as they kind of get to the other side of the Misty Mountains.
He hasn't actually said a word yet, so it'd be interesting. Maybe he's a silent character. Ooh. Who knows?
Could be interesting.
Well, he has his son.
He was involved. He wasn't just doing.
All of them are singing.
He wasn't just doing the beat.
He's beatboxing. That's his unique talent. What do we think of the songs? And will he be singing again in 2 and 3?
I love that dwarf song.
That's what Bilbo Baggins hates song.
No,
that
one. No, no.
There will be Elvish singing in part two because.
That's what
As they're walking through Mirkwood, we're going to really lose you here, Chris. As they walk through Mirkwood, the elves are trying to lure them off the path.
It's not a spoiler that anyone
has
seen
the first
walk.
It could develop
somewhere
into some kind of rap battle at that point.
That'd be amazing.
Clear.
I would really like to see that.
Brett McKenzie could possibly be involved in that. Awesome.
Brett McKenzie, who was in The Hobbit as a different hot elf, right? He wasn't the same hot elf.
Same guy.
Same hot elf?
Yeah.
Okay.
Peewip.
Sorry, you have two different names there.
Formerly Figwit.
Oh, that was it.
Now Lindir.
I call him Peewip.
You know why he was called Figwit, right?
Of course I do. But refresh my memory.
Right, hang on. Let me actually try and remember this. It's okay. So Figwit stands for Frodo is great. Who is that? Which some deranged fan came up with that acronym.
Because he didn't
after,
have a name.
After noticing him in the, because he's just kind of standing there as a kind of extra.
And did they notice him because he was Brett McKenzie from Flight of the Conchords, or did they notice him because he was Hot Elf?
That predated Flight of the Conchords. That was 2001. So Holy Flight of the Conchords may just have been on the radio at that point.
Holy cow.
We won't be seeing the Fat Elf, though, will we?
Which Fat Elf?
The Fat Elf, because the one that dies in the Two Towers.
Oh, I really like him.
Yeah,
Haldir.
I really like
him. He won't be in this.
Might be.
Could be.
Good thing. Okay. I like it.
Ooh. Yeah.
Why not?
Okay. My favourite dwarf is Thorin Oakenshield.
Oh, nice.
My favourite dwarf is Boffer, because he's played by Jimmy Nesbitt, and it was delightful to hear a local accent suddenly in the middle of Middle Earth.
Yes.
Because he's literally from the next town over from the one I'm from.
I did wonder about where the dwarfs are. What? Hang on. Beaufort is from the next town over to you.
Beaufort is from Colrin.
Colrin,
you know, it's in the Iron Hills.
Good old Jimmy Nesbitt. Yes, no, absolutely. I was always a little bit baffled by where the dwarfs are from and the sort of how wide an area they're from for the accents to be so different. So some are Scottish.
Yeah.
Some are Northern Irish.
Yeah.
And Richard Armitage, Thorin Oakenshield's from Yorkshire.
Yep.
Occasionally. And so...
Well, I mean, you know, if you think about it, you know, the UK is not a terribly large area and we have all these incredibly different accents. So really it makes sense. Just don't overthink it, Chris.
I'm not trying to overthink
it. They're doing anything. Exactly the same as they did with the Rings trilogy, where the orcs were Cockneys and the elves were kind of posh British people and the men were Northern, essentially, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Going back to the dwarves, I very much enjoyed, I can't remember his name, but I very much enjoyed the one with the ear trumpet, because he was having a rough time. Someone was pouring beer in his ear trumpet in the first scene, and then he had to put tissue in it when the elves were singing. And then someone trod on his trumpet and broke it, but fortunately he had a backup.
Oh, no.
He had a backup. That was really worrying.
Is it Oin?
I think it might be.
Oin.
Okay, so moving on. Movies 2 and 3, or certainly the second movie, is going to bring us Smaug. Because it's called The Desolation of Smaug. But what
which is a place, which is actually a place.
Yes.
A place.
It's a place.
An area desolated by Smaug.
Oh, that's what it means.
That's because they're moving into that area. That's going to go into that area, you see. That's why it's called that.
So he's not being desolated. He's done the desolating.
Well, there's an element of, you know, he's kind of a sad character in some ways. He's
Smaug.
A bit on his own. Yeah, he's a bit on his own.
He's not a sad character
at all.
Well,
he's all excited when the guy comes up and he has a chance to talk to him. He gets, you know, a bit... So I think he's lonely. I think he's just misunderstood, really.
He's the lonely mountain.
You see? So he's lonely because he's lived there all that time.
I wouldn't feel sorry for Smaug.
Is he almost an echo of Gollum?
No.
You know, Gollum is sitting in a cave guarding this thing which he loves but he can't use, right? And Smaug has the same stuff. He's got all this money.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, but he's onto something.
Actually, that's a good thought. But I would say that it's not quite the same, because Smaug is written in such a way as that's just what dragons do. Do you know what I mean? Obviously, I don't know how they're adapting it, but there is that sense that this is the, you know, this is why you hate dragons, because they like to hoard treasure. But obviously, they can't do anything with it, but they hoard it.
We'll see what he does, what they do with him, because he could be played as a kind of tragic character. Could be. Mm.
That would be interesting. I'm not sure how I'd feel about that.
It's interesting, actually. I talked to a couple of Tolkien experts to write about the writing of The Hobbit recently, and one of them, Tom Shippey, who has written a very good book on it, look it up, he said they describe Smaug as wearing a waistcoat made of jewels that he's sort of, you know, got on his body.
And they've pressed into him over time, haven't they?
Well, this is it. I mean, he was saying, did someone literally make a waistcoat? And if so, who? And they've never kind of examined that kind of question. But I thought it would just press into him over time.
Pressed into his scales.
But they literally, you know, they're clearly there pretty solidly.
Wonder if he has a moth problem with his wardrobe.
I guess we'll see in parts 2 and 3. I don't think we'll see much of him in the next film. I think we'll see a bit.
Really?
I don't know.
Because I think it's going to take a while to get through. This is a wild guess.
I feel like they're going to finish the movie with that battle.
Wow.
I might be wrong, but if it's a three-hour movie, that's not completely insane that could be the climax, because you've got so much stuff still to go with the third one. I feel like if you put the battle with Smaug and the Battle of Five Armies, aren't you just going to put all the action into one film?
I mean, this is what I love about The Hobbit. is so much happens. I mean, I suppose this is a spoiler podcast, so we can say this, can't we? Mm-hmm. So much happens after Smaug dies. Mm. And it's a complete, the idea of it being, you know, get the treasure, kill the dragon story, and it ends with
changes
Smaug dying.
A lot, yeah.
And I love what happens after that. It's like, it's really interesting. It's kind of how it changes, and also the effect on Thorin as well. Mm. And I think Thorin's a closer parallel to Gollum than Smaug is. Ooh. For reasons which I won't go into right now, but I think he's going to have the Gollum elements come the third film.
Interesting.
But I think it would be a very cool ending for them to kind of almost complete the quest at the end of the second film and then almost kind of come out and see all these armies emerging, and that'd be pretty...
Yeah, I think it's a power vacuum. That's what I love about it, the idea that Smaug dies. There's a power vacuum. All of a sudden, there's this... Basically, it's a country's economy sitting there unclaimed, except now you've got 13 dwarves sat on it. And like everyone else is going, well, hang on a minute, you know, we want a piece of that.
And how are they going to keep hold of it?
Yeah. Exactly.
You and Phil, as you know, you were there. You interviewed Richard Armitage, Andy Serkis, Martin Freeman for the podcast, and you asked him about Hobbits 2 and 3. And that information is in the new issue of Empire next week. And in it, Richard Armitage actually talks about they haven't filmed the Battle of the Five Armies yet, and they're going back later on this year. And I don't imagine they'll get that set piece done in time for release in December. I'd be very, very surprised. So I imagine that'll be in movie 3.
I think the Battle of the Five Armies definitely.
Okay. Oh, I thought you were saying
I'm speculating that all the Smaug stuff could be in the next one.
Yeah.
And then the Battle of the Five Armies would be in 3 as a kind of
I'm not sure about all of it, but I think
I wouldn't be surprised if the whole second film is beginning and end of Smaug.
I wouldn't be surprised either, and they're clearly setting up the Necromancer as a big bad as well.
This is an interesting thing because of course Benedict Cumberbatch quite early on said something about his character being at the Battle of Five Legions. Not A, he'd obviously got the name wrong, but B...
Said that to me. Sherlock.
But B, you know, that sounds very, very much like the Necromancer actually plays a role there, which would make a lot of sense actually to tie the whole thing together. And, you know, so you don't just have Gandalf going off completely separately, dealing with the Necromancer and coming back and facing this new battle. You actually tie those two big conflicts together, which would seem, you know, if cinematically, thematically would seem to work.
Yeah, I think a lot of the complaints from people that this film didn't feel like a satisfying thing as a whole and didn't have the huge set piece and scale that the Lord of the Rings film. I think the films 2 and 3 are going to blow anything.
They're
going to
knock
the Rings
your socks off.
I thought Goblin Town was pretty big. I mean, that was a big one.
Yeah, it was all right. I don't think it was Helm's Deep. I don't think it was Pelennor Fields.
No, it wasn't.
I don't think it was even the Mines of Moria.
It didn't have the tone of those set pieces either. I mean, there was a bit of a knockabout romp.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, especially the last hour or so, but the action is pretty relentless in the scale of Goblin Town, just the sheer depth and the complexity of the set, the CG sets and the practical sets together.
Sure. It reminded me of King Kong.
It was fantastic.
A lot of the way he mounted it.
Yeah.
You know, that scene where Anne is falling down the ravine and swinging from the vines and stuff. It was very much that kind of set piece rather than something like Helm's Deep that is just full on intense and you feel like there's stuff at stake. It didn't really feel like that.
So the Necromancer was interesting to me, glimpsed very, very briefly in this movie, and we know he's Benedict Cumberbatch, and correct me if I'm wrong here, he turns out to be Sauron, am I right in thinking?
Yes, he's basically kind of reconstituting himself after losing a battle a couple of eons ago. So the
Voldemort style.
Yes, so the sort of, it's taken a bit longer than it did.
Lord of the Rings was written first, Chris.
I know, Dan,
Talk to the kids, Dan.
Yes, I didn't know that.
So he's sort of growing up again, and that's why there's all this talk of the shadow descending on the forest, because his stronghold of Dol Guldur is at the far end of Mirkwood.
There's that little line about it was once called Greenwood, wasn't it?
Exactly.
They say that, and now it's turned into this. You know,
and so it's kind of spreading. So Lothlorien obviously is holding strong because you've got Galadriel there, but it's kind of spreading over parts of the rest of the wood and beginning to threaten the wood elves' kind of domain as well.
And Sebastian is one of the.
It's interesting. We got to see the Witch King of Angmar cameo.
We did.
That was a nice cameo.
Yeah.
So presumably, you know, part of the kind of the mythos is that the Nazgul are all being raised from the dead.
Yes, the Ringwraiths are coming back.
Yeah. So do you think we'll get to see some more of that stuff happening?
It'll be interesting to see if we see them in action again. If we are going to see the Necromancer turn up at the Battle of Five Armies, is he going to have the nine with him to lead the orcs into battle? I mean, that's, you know, is that possible at this point? It might make, it might feel a bit too climactic, if that's possible. It might feel like you need to hold something back because The Lord of the Rings is meant to be a much bigger, much scarier conflict. So maybe you can't have the Nine there, but it's not beyond the realm of possibility.
I think there is going to be, there's another element. If you go to the first Hobbit trailer, and there's a scene in which Gandalf is fighting somebody at Dol Guldur. If you pause it and look carefully, that somebody he's fighting is kind of dwarfy-sized.
I think that's Frain, who's Thorin's father, who in the book is driven insane and sort of living in these creepy catacombs. And he has the key to Erebor, which is where Gandalf, when he pulls the key out at Bag End, that's where he's got it from. So I wonder whether we'll get to see a flashback of that. That is what I thought it was going to...
Yeah, I thought they were going to explain that at that point in Bag End, that Gandalf was going to kind of tell that story and we were going to see that flashback to him in Dol Guldur. But maybe that's sort of still to be explained or still to come.
Okay.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
So we're going to get to see Gandalf, Saruman, Radagast, and Galadriel all storming Dol Guldur. That's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
I can't imagine Radagast storming anything. It's a very awe-inspiring sight.
If he's got Sebastian by his side.
Yeah, if his brain's addled by mushrooms. Yes.
Well,
he'll throw hedgehogs.
We're yet to see what he's capable of. I imagine that he'll surprise us.
He had that Gandalf-y moment, didn't he, where the background went a bit dark and he said words of power.
Was that him? Oh, yeah, of course. You're right.
That was a very good impression, Dan. Well done.
Thank you.
He to fight off the evil. That was the evil of the necromancer, right?
Yeah, that was the spiders of Mirkwood.
The spiders of Mirkwood.
Making a little cameo.
Who are distantly related, obviously, to Shelob.
I thought they were Shelob's children.
Yeah, they're descendants of Shelob. I mean, not literally her children. You know, I'm thinking grandchildren, great-grandchildren. Okay.
So there were quite a few LOTR alumni in this movie from... Obviously, Gandalf and Galadriel and Elrond Hubbard turned up for a little bit at the end. And we can expect a few more. And what did we think of those cameos? Did it make it seem more of a piece? Was there anyone who was maybe superfluous? I know you said already, Frodo, you could have done without Frodo.
I love Frodo as a character. I just wanted it to get started. You wanted to get moving at that point. And it took quite a while to crank up.
We're not going
to
see Merry and Pippin and
Sam, unless
they come into the framing device.
I mean, in the framing device, so that's
something. Well, the framing device ended pretty definitively just before the 11th birthday party, didn't it? Where they are introduced. I think it would be pushing it a bit to bring them into it now.
Presumably at the end, he'll find the finished book.
I guess.
We might cut back to that at the very end of the story, which we kind of saw a bit of that already. It looked like Bilbo had finished writing the story in a day.
Nick
explained this to me. He finishes it in Rivendell, is that right?
He finishes it, you see him, he goes, I finally finished my book. To Frodo when he turns up. There is some speculation about why, if he's written this book for Frodo, it starts off by explaining what a hobbit hole is, which is kind of fair enough.
If you go to the extended edition of Fellowship of the Ring, it starts with concerning hobbits, in which Bilbo is writing about what hobbits are and what have you.
That's even more confusing.
So I could imagine it's almost like that could be part of the concerning hobbits.
Just in case Frodo gets bumped on the head by a Nazgul and forgets what a hobbit is.
Let's be honest, I want to see Bilbo going out, leaving Bag End, looking for an agent, trying to get it published.
I think it was written for an elf audience as well, especially given that he finishes it in Rivendell and that he's living there for the last few years of his life, or most of them. Maybe it's for the elves. Maybe he rewrote chapter one.
So who writes The Lord of the Rings then in this continuity?
Frodo.
Radagast.
Frodo writes it?
Yeah.
I've seen nothing in what Frodo does or says in that trilogy to make me think that he has the intelligence to write
a 1,000-word book.
1,000 word book.
1,000 words. Sorry. Steady. Yes.
Twitter has it's really shrunk my 1,000 page book.
Yeah.
Or three books. Helen.
Her love of the halfling's weed has addled her mind.
I dropped my phone. All right.
Anyway, okay, yes. So who else can we expect to see then?
We're going to see Legolas.
We are going to see Legolas.
Who
else is going to turn up?
Well, we're going to have Bjorn, although that's not a returning character. But he's a key person in the next film.
They did think about bringing Arwen and Aragorn back. Philippa Boyens told us that.
Decided against it. Okay.
Can I just say, because this movie doesn't have a love story or really any strong female characters. Mm. That's just, I guess, by sheer dint of the book not having any. But yep. I was kind of relieved not to have Arwen and Aragorn making moon eyes at each other endlessly. I was kind of happy that they weren't in it.
You hard-hearted bastard.
But who's Toriel?
Tariel.
Sorry?
Tariel.
Tariel.
I got corrected. That is the correct Elvish pronunciation, although it's a new character for the film.
Right. Tariel.
Yes.
Okay. So is she going to be a love interest for Thorin?
No, could be.
You know, because he hates elves. I hate it. I hate elves. Oh, she's nice.
I love elves. Elves are great.
Caveman.
Thorin Oakenshield.
Thorin Hungry.
I wonder if that would be a dwarf elf love story would be too far, going too far.
Well, you know,
that would enrage people, wouldn't it?
I don't know.
It would.
Nothing wrong with a bit of interspecies.
People have open minds these days, Nick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not saying I'm anti the idea.
Elf dwarfish.
Judge lest ye be judged.
By Judge Reinhold. Okay, I've got a couple of last questions before we wrap this thing up.
Okay.
Dan, I know you wanted to tackle this one in particular. It's from at Tim Smedley.
Mm-hmm.
And a vein started throbbing in your head when you read this one first. When directors become too powerful, they make overblown fantasy epics that could do with a decent edit. Discuss. And that's from at Tim Smedley.
Well, I think that is true in some cases. I don't think it's fair in this case. I mean, let's not forget that originally Peter Jackson was not the director of this film. Once upon a time, it was going to be a Guillermo del Toro film.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackson was quite clear he didn't want to direct it. And he was just going to produce. And then, of course, Guillermo dropped out and they tried to find a director. And Jackson, as I understand it, stepped in pretty much and then thought, well, actually, I can do something with this. So I'm not quite sure that makes it count as a great big vanity project.
I think he's referring to the length of it and the sense that it's padded out.
Well, I think it's quite clear that obviously he may be the director, but there is quite clearly a team which puts these films together. So he co-writes it, doesn't he, with Philippa Boyens and with Fran Walsh.
Yeah. But working very closely.
Yes.
So, I mean, come on. If he wanted it to be a shorter film, it would be a shorter film.
I do get the sense, I did a lot of interviews for a recent article we did.
Mm.
It was kind of an oral history of Peter Jackson's life. And I talked to Jamie Selkirk, who edited the Lord of the Rings films and King Kong, and is not coming back for this one. I got a sense that he did have tussles, especially on King Kong, where he was kind of saying, he would go, oh, come on, Pete, we can lose this scene. We can cut this. And I think, you know, it comes from a good place that Jackson, I don't think, you know, he's not going, I'm doing what I want.
Mm.
I think he gets really attached to the characters and the story and he wants to put as much as he can in. And there are a lot of fans that appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, he said that much himself, really, but certainly about the end of Return of the King. He pretty much said that he didn't want to cut any of those scenes out because he liked them. And he is aware of all the criticisms of the multiple endings and kind of takes them on board and said, yeah, I just did this anyway because I loved them. And I think, so I think that's right. I don't think it's a vanity thing at all. I think it's just a being in love with the story thing.
Yeah. I mean, I do wonder if like Tarantino, that he could maybe do with someone who can sit in the edit room with him and say, you know, we really need to lose this.
Mm.
Someone that he'd listen to.
Yeah.
There's a sense that Django Unchained is...
I know, I mean, if I think a film's too long, then I will certainly say so, and I have said that about Django Unchained,
which I
did really enjoy, just for the record. I absolutely love Django Unchained, but I just felt it was too long. I didn't feel The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, was too long. I didn't sit there thinking, God, this is going on, isn't it?
No, I barely looked at my watch, and I only looked at my watch really to sort of mark what time things were happening.
Hmm.
Whereas with certain films, when Nick and I saw a film recently, we're embargoed, sadly, we can't say what it was, but for the last hour, I was looking at my watch every 2 or 3 minutes, roughly, sighing loudly and going,
"When
will this shit ever end?"
Yeah.
Yes, yes. And we'll discuss that when the embargo's lifted and then it comes out next year. Yay, fun.
No, I didn't think this was. I didn't think this was too long. I thought there were bits that could have been tighter, definitely, but I wasn't bored at all.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, King Kong. You can really make a case that just.
I think King Kong. This statement applies almost entirely. The overblown fantasy epic that could do with a decent edit. That applies to King Kong. And for me, The Hobbit doesn't apply. There are certain you could maybe trim down sequences. I don't think you could lose any sequence because every sequence furthered the plot in some way. Every scene developed the story in some way. So it would be very, very tough to lose stuff without the whole house of cards collapsing. Even the washing up song.
Mark Kermode made a very funny remark on his radio show. This is a film that could do with having its appendix removed, which is a very funny line, but I don't agree with it because I think that stuff is going to really pay off in a way that we haven't seen yet.
I said this in my review. I did feel that a lot of the cuts to the Dol Guldur and the Necromancer stuff didn't feel relevant to Bilbo's story, which is ultimately what this is. But obviously this has been made, adapted as a prequel to The Lord of the Rings, and those strands are being brought in. And I think in the next film and the film after, they will tie together far better. Everything will start coming together more. But because of just the nature of this first film, they just felt a little bit, well, what's it got to do with anything, you know?
Can I throw one thing out there as well? We were talking about movies 2 and 3, and it's obviously called The Hobbit, but it's just saying it's going to be on a much wider canvas. And one thing that has always seemed strange to me about The Hobbit was that Bilbo, and this presumes knowledge of the book, so if you haven't read it, do, you know, read it and then come back, is unconscious for the Battle of the Five Armies. Is that going to change? Do you think they'll change that? Can they really have the lead character of the movies unconscious for a twin?
I like it.
I don't think he'll be unconscious for the full thing. I think we may see him unconscious at a certain point.
Okay.
Yeah, but they use that trick in Game of Thrones season 1 to great effect, I thought, when Tyrion Lannister gets knocked out on the way into battle.
True.
By doing that, they got to avoid showing the battle, which saved them tons of money.
Well, that's very handy with a TV budget, but might not be quite so popular if you try it in The Hobbit.
It would be hilarious if they did show, they had an hour and a half of all the armies building up, and then he falls over, bumps his head, and then it cuts to black, and then fades up.
Yeah, it's all finished.
Gandalf going, well, that was fun.
You'll never believe what just happened.
Yeah. Oh my word.
Things we could have told you. There's another question here. There's another leading question from someone I presume didn't like the film. It's from at Dispatchinator, who says, why wasn't it as good as it should have been? Way too much Del Toro influence in there. So this is interesting. How much of Guillermo is still in this film? And is it
the mountains?
The stone giants were
him.
I mean, I like that. It's in the book and it's just developed much more thoroughly here, which I thought was great.
I like to think, with Pacific Rim, I like to think they're two little elves in the head of the stone giants. synchronized punching.
That would be delightful. I don't think there's such a thing as too much Del Toro, personally. And I think you see his touches maybe around the design of some of the creatures. It's been suggested that the Goblin King is a bit of a Del Toro special, and that does kind of feel right. It
sounds
feels
like
the kind of grotesquery.
Which would be in Hellboy 2,
that he would come up with. So I think it's mostly a design thing rather than principally for me. That's certainly where I noticed it.
Well, he's still credited as a screenwriter on this, isn't he, as well?
Yeah, he is. Absolutely.
Do you think he was responsible for James Nesbitt's hat?
Yes, undoubtedly.
That's a good hat, actually.
You know, it's a good hat.
I like the hat.
Is it a good hat?
Yeah, it's similar to Radagast's, actually.
Right.
If you look. Yeah. There is definitely some hat similarity.
They go to the same milliners.
Perhaps. You don't hear that word enough in conversation anymore, do you? Milliners.
Hat. Milliners. Oh, milliner.
Okay. I like it.
I think we may have answered this question.
But I think originally, Del Toro had I remember reading a New Yorker profile of Guillermo, and he showed the reporter his notebook, which had all these sketches inside, and his original vision for the dwarves is they all had spiky helmets and sort of weird protuberances coming out of their armour and stuff. So that's all gone. I mean, Jackson has said that he effectively binned most of what Guillermo del Toro came up with, started again.
Yeah, they now feel more like the Time Bandits in terms of this kind of mad mix, although the Time Bandits obviously were constructed based on what they'd pilfered from different periods in time.
But
they had that kind of feel to them visually, to me. Yeah.
The little goblin scribe felt like a del Toro touch to me. I don't know if that's the case.
Salacious Crumb.
Yeah. He felt like something from a Hellboy film.
Okay, and I think we've probably answered all the questions now that anyone has to answer about this film. All the questions that anyone has to ask about this film, which means that's it for our second Hobbit Spoiler Special podcast. For more Hobbity podcast goodness, check out the 41st podcast, week 41, for interviews with Martin Freeman, Andy Serkis, Richard Armitage, and then, of course, there's the Philippa Boyens Spoiler Special as well. So, until our next Spoiler Special, which by my calculations, in terms of big films, is probably going to be Iron Man 3 in April, although there might be something before then, who knows, it's goodbye to Dan.
Namarie.
What?
Namarie.
What does that mean?
It's Elvish for goodbye. He's showing off.
Oh, it sounded good, though.
Thank you.
It's goodbye to Helen.
Farewell.
What's that mean?
It just means goodbye.
Oh, that's good. And goodbye to Nick.
I'm sorry, I'm whispering to my moth. He's going to fly over to you and say bye.
All right, good. It's goodbye from me. I'm off to hail a giant eagle. See you next time.